Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Carry-on luggage that follows you around the airport. A television you can roll up like a poster. Robots that cuddle you to sleep. Those are just a few of the gadgets on the floor at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. The annual trade show exhibits the latest consumer electronics from tech companies around the world. Some products might seem far-fetched now, but who knows? Next year, they might be everywhere. This hour on Point, what's on tech's deck in 2018? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What gadgets are you excited to see hit the market? What tech trends do you think will catch on in 2018? Does everything have to be connected to the web? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Joanna Stern, personal technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She spent the last week in Las Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show sampling the wares. Joanna, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
Looking back on the Vegas experience, is there a star of the show? Is there something that you came across that you thought, wow, somebody finally made this?
So many choices, but I have to say the self-driving luggage. I mean, I was pulling my luggage through the airport yesterday, and I was thinking, God, why doesn't this thing just follow me? In all seriousness, no. Though I did have a lot of fun seeing that this bag. It's from a Chinese company, but there are actually four different companies showing self-driving luggage at CES this year. So while on one side of the show we had all of these major car manufacturers showing self-driving cars, on the other side of the show we had these startups showing luggage that follows you around and has a mind of its own.
So how do I know that my underwear is not going to just follow somebody else when we're in the concourse?
I mean, there's no technology to know where your underwear specifically is going. But basically how it works is it depends on which of the bags. But the idea, the premise is fundamentally the same. Something that you have on your body pairs with the bag. So that could be your smartphone. That could be a remote. That could be a watch that you wear. And it knows that it needs to follow that thing. So it pairs wirelessly. And as you walk, supposedly, and I will tell you, this did not really happen a lot during my demos, it should follow you. During the demos that I had of one called the Puppy One, this is the name of the bag because it follows you around like a puppy, it worked at times, but other times it sort of had a mind of its own and went in reverse and fell on the ground.
Is this part of what CES really does? Showcases where things are going, and maybe these products aren't quite as good as they need to be, aren't quite as good as they're going to be, but you know that that's self-driving luggage that's going to stick with you in an airport is in our future.
Yeah, CES is all about the potential of the technology. And one of the fun things that I like to do at go to at CES is see, okay, this is a technology and this is a way that this company is putting it to use. That might not be the best way to put it to use, but it's good to know that this is a technology, that it's a thing, and that this may come to a different form of our gadgets or a different way of integrating our lives. And, that will potentially make a difference.
What, is there a trend this year that sort of is the umbrella trend? In earlier years when I've read about the show, web mm-hmm. connectivity to everything was one year's big, big theme. Voice activation was a big thing in another year. Was there a sort of trope, an idea, a theme where you thought, huh, everybody's sort of tinkering with this?
Yeah, I would say broadly, I mean, all the things you've mentioned are still really big themes, right? Putting the internet in everything, voice control, the prevalence of Alexa and Google Assistant. But I would say encompassing almost all of that is artificial intelligence. The idea that our gadgets, our computers are going to get smarter on their own, that they are going to become sort of a being that understands us better, and that they're not just sort of programmed by engineers, that the software doesn't just live in a silo and it does what it's told. And so you see that sort of spanning into a couple of different areas. Voice is one. You know, Alexa and the Google Assistant, whether you've got an Amazon Echo or you've got a Google Home device, that is a first step to getting us comfortable talking to computers, interacting with computers in a different way than using a mouse, than using our finger. And so that's a first step to these devices getting smarter and to us trusting them more. I really believe that. And you're seeing artificial intelligence in that, but you're really also starting to see it spread into other types of things where you might not even know it's artificial intelligence. So obviously we know self-driving cars, that's artificial intelligence. That's robotics. That's a device that a car that is going to make decisions on our behalf, and that is extremely scary. And that's probably the extreme, right? But before we get there, there are lots of other types of gadgets and lots of types of things that are going to use artificial intelligence. And, you know, the companies are claiming this is going to make our life better for everything from, you know, artificial intelligence can improve our battery life to improve what photos we see on our phone to improve, you know, the temperature in our office.
I'm wondering whether some of these companies haven't cut the throat on their own goose that lays the golden eggs by what we've been learning about, for instance, data collection from these interactive devices that are in the home, that companies have the ability to monetize what they learn from us while offering us a product that we think is just convenient because it helps the house do things that we want it to do, for instance. But actually, they're listening to us and collecting information from us all the time.
Yeah, I'm worried about exactly what you just said. So I think the number one thing these companies need to be working on, and I don't care what product it is, whatever, it's trust. They need to figure out the trust that they have with us to then allow us to open up to these next ideas, whether that's letting a microphone in our kitchen, a camera in our bedroom, you know, all sorts of crazy things that you can then also give to your kids, whether that's a camera in their bedroom or a voice-controlled robot that they're supposed to interact with. I mean, all of these things, fundamentally, these companies need to, their first product needs to be trust. And I think so. My biggest concern is that actually consumers might not care. And so how many of us have let these Alexa, the microphones, the Amazon Echoes into our houses? And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I love the Echo and I love interacting with Alexa to do, you know, everything from tell me the weather in the morning to set the chicken timer. But it becomes very clear to me many times when I speak to people that they don't really understand how that works. And so it's on us as consumers and on the companies to explain how this stuff works. And then we can make the decision on, do we want to let that microphone into our bedroom or that camera into our bedroom?
In a Kickstarter campaign video for the Somnox sleep robot, Somnox founder Julian Jachtenberg explained how the gadget lulls consumers to sleep.
Meet the Somnox sleep robot, your ultimate sleep companion that improves sleep by soothing body and mind, reducing stress and anxiety, so you can fall asleep faster, deeper, and wake up feeling refreshed. It does so by providing a range of effective and proven features, breathing regulation, sounds, and affection. By hugging the Somnox sleep robot at night, you will feel it breathe. And by feeling the rising and falling sensation of its breathing, you will subconsciously adjust your own breathing rhythm accordingly.
It sounds great, but it doesn't take much imagination to imagine a world also where a doctor can find out that you haven't had a complete night's sleep in a week, or a pharmaceutical company could find out that you haven't been sleeping well and suddenly you're getting emails for sleep aids. I mean, yeah.
Well, my mind went to something different, which really sounded like that robot was a replacement for another human that you should sleep next to.
Tell me about it. But yeah, I guess maybe Tinder, you'll get emails from them instead.
Right. Right.
We're going to start in Baltimore, Maryland. Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
So I'm calling with a concern to the future of the automotive industry. So I work as a Mercedes-Benz technician, and one large concern that I have with the changing industry is with the increased proliferation of electric vehicles and the electric driveline. So it's widely accepted that, you know, the internal combustion engine is going to go away. But when it's replaced by the electric drivetrain, despite all the advantages that it has, one of the advantages I see as a disadvantage, it has a lot less moving components, a lot less complicated pieces. There's a lot less wear. And so there's a lot less service that needs to be done. You don't need to, say, change your brake pads as often. You don't need oil changes. You don't need to change belts. All these regular menial service tasks that provide a whole sector of the automotive industry will go away. And my concern is, what will replace this? What will make up for this loss?
And this is knowledge, Madison, that you spent a lot of time and effort acquiring, and you're worried about nobody wanting to buy it.
Right.
Well, Joanna Stern, the world of the self-driving car and autonomous transportation has been promised to us at CES and other industry confabs for years. Do you feel us getting closer?
Yes, we're definitely getting closer to this technology working and to this technology becoming safer. Lots of the biggest companies are working on that, from Google to Uber to tech companies in general. The big thing that I think stands in front of us is the regulatory issues and the safety of actually getting these on the road.
We're talking about what's hot and what's not. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And we are here with a new show,
The Indicator from Planet Money.
On every show, we take some number in the news and we dive into it to find the big idea behind it.
Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about all the new gadgets on display at this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. My guest this hour is Joanna Stern, personal technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Neil writes on Twitter, "What we actually need is to have real problems addressed with robust devices that are repairable and upgradable." And Jaso writes, "How will they improve people's lives and their appreciation of how they live their lives? How do these things bring greater depth and richness to this experience called living?" Joining us now is one of the exhibitors at the Consumer Electronics Show, Edward Hall. He's the founder and CEO of Petrix, a company that makes smart beds for your pets. He's presenting the product in Las Vegas this week. He joins us from there. Edward, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of beds, if people think about the beds in their house, one of the dumbest objects in the house. What is a smart bed, and why does your pet need one?
Yeah, so, we're introducing the world's first smart pet bed that actually tracks your pet's weight and even offers climate control and comes with a paired activity tracker that uses the identification of the pet, so you can use it for more than one pet and only have to use one bed to track their information. And the activity tracker also tracks their activity and calories burned, so we get a really good health snapshot of your pet. And that way you can stay ahead of health issues early, and we can notify if we start noticing some trends that would be negative and, you know, might warrant you to contact your veterinarian so they can get ahead of the health issue before it becomes more serious and costly.
So this bed can tell me things that my pet is incapable of telling me.
That's right. We really do try to provide a voice for the pet. It's very important. You know, if my stomach hurts, I can tell you, but pets typically can't. And unfortunately, when it comes to pets, especially cats, we usually only notice the problem when it's, you know, really progressed. So this is a really good way to kind of stay ahead of that and let them tell you when they're not feeling well, instead of you finding out way down the road where now you might have irreversible damage, or it's escalated to the point you need surgery instead of maybe just antibiotics.
I understand that one of the biggest problems with pets now, both cats and dogs, is gaining too much weight. Can the Petrix bed help me with that?
So that's absolutely one of the biggest problems in the pet industry. It all starts in nutrition and weight management. Currently, over 53% of all cats and dogs in the U.S. are overweight and obese. You know, and you can ask your vet about it, too, and they'll confirm that this is a really big problem. It's more of an epidemic. And so they're really trying to push for this awareness and the importance when you come to these clinics to really monitor that stuff. But it's hard. I mean, let's face it, you know, we live busy day-to-day lives. So it's difficult for us, let alone to try to get a pet to stay on the scale. But, you know, even if you do it in other ways, it's just, you know, trying to do that every 2 weeks, it becomes an added chore, and it becomes kind of inconvenient. So a lot of the compliance side that vets recommend just don't happen for very long after they leave the office. A lot of vets will see they do it for maybe a week or 2 weeks, and then they just go back to their normal schedule.
Is this an expensive piece of equipment?
So the prices, the beds will actually come in small, medium, and large, and the prices will range between $100 to $300. But like I said, they also include an activity tracker too. So it really becomes a worthwhile system for that. And then there's also a free mobile application too that you'll be able to download and track your pet's nutrition and even get food recommendations based on your pet's specific needs. So not just it'll actually be based on like breed or predisposed genetic risks, existing medical conditions, food allergies, and many more other factors that we can assess. Plus, on top of it, we'll be able to take the data and have more information towards that.
Edward Hall is the founder and CEO of Petrix, a startup that makes a smart bed for your pet. Edward, thanks for joining us on the show today. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
We'll go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin next, where Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ray. My first reaction to the robot that helps you sleep was one of psychological addiction. I don't think people realize how quickly, maybe they do, how much addiction we have with people who are, they're addicted to screens and iPhones. But this robot that would help you fall asleep, that could be a very, very quick addiction that you need to have, like sleeping pills. And that's what I worry about when we talk about smart anything. All the technology that we have can easily become, we become slaves to the technology. And that's what I always think about when I first hear about these new conveniences.
Isn't that robot, Mike, a more benign option than taking chemicals to help you sleep? I mean, if you just need something to hug and that'll help you drift off, might that be better than actually using sleeping pills?
Well, compared to chemicals, I guess there's always a trade-off to everything, and all technology has trade-offs, and that's what people who embrace things without thinking about what they're giving up, because we have a tendency to be dependent upon these, particularly if we need them, and psychological addictions to chemicals is not any. It's not great either, but I just think there's the dark side to the technology that a lot of people don't they're not even aware of, but I think they need to be aware of whenever we take anything that makes our lives simpler and requires less thinking and less human intuition.
Mike from Milwaukee, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go to New Orleans next. Another Mike. Mike from New Orleans, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Just wanted to share a brief story that happened a couple of nights ago, and then I can take a response off the air. But some friends of mine and I were just hanging out, and he had sort of made a joke that I had a Costanza wallet, if you remember from the Seinfeld episode. He had kind of the overly sized wallet with all kinds of stuff in it. So we sort of joked about that and kind of took stuff out of our wallets and said, okay, we need this, and so... Anyways, the whole conversation was just around like thinning down your wallet. So anyways, pretty benign conversation. the next day I woke up and I had a banner ad. I think it was on like maybe Weather Underground or something, not just trying to sell me a smaller wallet, but the tag on it was literally geared towards going from a thicker wallet to a thinner wallet. So it was just really creepy. Clear. So then the next day we actually went ahead and we just sort of jokingly said, well, let's just test this out. And so we had this long sort of ad nauseum conversation about how we really wanted to buy some potted plants. And we just kind of went on and on and on, being very elaborate about just saying the word potted plant, just to see if the next day we would have a banner ad about it. And we didn't. So I don't know if it was just a coincidence, but it was just so creepy that not only were we having a conversation about wallets, but literally having a thinner wallet. And then I got a banner ad the next day about how to thin down your wallet. It was just creepy.
Can I jump in here?
Go ahead, Joanna.
Did at any point, did you ever search for the word wallet?
No, uh-uh.
Never on Google, never.
I mean, not that I
mean, not in the in the, in the last couple of weeks.
Years.
Okay.
No,
so this is something.
Wallet for years.
So this is something that a number of people in the tech industry are already talking about. And the question is Facebook, are any of these companies using the microphones on our phone to listen to our conversations and then target ads at us? There's no evidence that this is actually happening. One argues, and I forget the social scientist that wrote this piece, that it's psychological, that we're having this conversation and then we see something and we think, oh, that's weird. But it seems that right now there's a little bit more at play and it's unclear where that data could be coming from. One thing, I had a similar, not as creepy experience as you, but I went shopping to get shoes. I went to DSW in New York City. I went to go get shoes. I bought a pair of Cole Haan shoes. I never searched for Cole Haan. I never searched for shoes. The next day on Facebook, I saw an ad for Cole Haan shoes. Now, one thing that is happening is credit card data. I might have paid with a Chase credit card, or I don't remember which specific credit card, is being provided at times to three-party services that are then providing that information to Facebook because it knows who you are. My point being is that there are a lot of different ways this could be happening. That said, I think there are a number of journalists and people looking into the microphone question.
Our next call is from Littleton, Massachusetts. Mark is on the line. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Yes, Ray. Thank you for taking the call. And first, I'd like to say how much I think the show has improved since you've taken over. I love the show. The statement I have is, with all these new technologies, and I love the idea of the self-driving car, it seems like it would really take a lot of pressure off of a lot of different people. My worry is in, with all the hacking that goes on, what would happen, you know, if someone hacked into the controls of these cars? I put my mother in the car, send her to her, you know, her daycare center or whatever. The car gets hacked. The person who hacked the car pulls it into his driveway and proceeds to take her pocketbook or worse. You know, has any protections in this along these lines gone into the thought about all these different technologies about anti-hacking or securing the software that motivates these things? And I'll take my answer off the line. I don't need to tie it up.
Mark, thanks for your call. Joanna, it's obviously a concern.
It's a huge concern, and I think we think right now, how many of us have a problem handling our passwords for our Gmail or for our just, you know, our iCloud, and that we're all going to be responsible for the security of our cars and all of our home, and is a password or is, you know, a second form of authentication really enough? And that's where many of these companies are looking to the security and the technology industry to say, what is going to be the security protection that keeps us across all of these devices, much safer and much more clamped down. The it's a really interesting question because I haven't heard much yet from these car companies on how they're thinking about that. Kind of tangential, but one of the things that I loved the most that I saw at the show this year was a car called the Byton Concept Car. And this is from a Chinese company, has taken a lot of employees from places like Apple and Tesla, and they're making this incredibly futuristic car that they actually say will come out in 2020. And the one of the ways you get into the car is it has a camera on the outside. It uses facial recognition, similar to the new iPhone X. Uses facial recognition, sees your face, unlocks the car, also has a fingerprint sensor built in if you want a second way of getting, you know, second form of authenticating it's you. And then it will change the display on the inside. It will customize it because it knows it's you're the driver, and it will, you know, pop up your favorite radio station or whatnot. So that's at least one way that we're seeing some better security around these things beyond just a key.
Earlier this week for NBC's Today Show, Jo-Ling Kent reported on this year's Consumer Electronics Show and the latest robots for your home.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
The friendly-looking bots like Jibo use artificial intelligence to help with homework and stream music. This voice-activated Kiker can project your favorite TV shows and provide home security. It costs $1,800. Relay's Priscilla at the Renaissance Hotel in Las Vegas helps deliver items to guests and checks on the speed of your Wi-Fi.
Joanna Stern, aren't there a lot of things we still have to figure out? Just what a machine that a person would be comfortable interacting with would look like? Do we give it a child's face? Do we give it a woman's face? Do we give it a man's voice? Maybe we answer those questions in different ways depending on what we want the machine to do. We're pretty early days in this, aren't we?
We're very early days in this. And actually, the robot that she mentioned at the beginning of that segment, the Jibo, I lived with the Jibo in my house for about a month. And I enjoyed it. It is very limited, and it is certainly not the robot of the future. But it, you know, it dances, it talks to you, it answers the weather, it does these things. But one thing that it does is it sort of looks at you. It learns your face, and it will turn around and look at you, and it will say, "Hi, Joanna." It's hilarious. And so, like, I would be cleaning the dishes in the kitchen, and he would say, "Oh, hi, Joanna. Good afternoon. Would you like to know something fun?" And I said, "Okay." And he would say some random thing like, "Did you know it's the actor who played Stephen Urkel on Family Matters' birthday today?" I'm like, "No, I didn't need to know that, but thank you, Jibo." And so it illustrates a lot of things, but my point really is here. So I didn't have a terrible reaction to Jibo. I thought, all right, this thing is cute, and I'm writing this review of it. But my wife had a terrible reaction to Jibo, mostly because Jibo would turn around when she was doing something and she didn't want Jibo to see what she was doing or whatever she was doing. And it would just stare at her and say, "Hi, Michelle." I would come home from work sometimes and Jibo would be in the corner and unplugged. One time she played a joke on me and placed Jibo in the garbage can. She wanted this robot out of the house. And what this illustrates is that a lot of us may have one reaction, and then some of us may have a totally different reaction to these things. And that is a very hard thing for these companies to figure out.
I was at a robotics lab at a major American university, and one of the things they're working hardest on is companions for people who are lonely. So it wouldn't apply in your household, where you have not only a partner, but a partner who hated the robot.
Yeah, no, and actually a funny thing that you said is that we actually had a nanny at some days, and she loved Jibo because I think she was a little bit lonely during the day because she was with our child is a 6-month-old, and she's like talking to Jibo, and, you know, and another thing is that they're, you know, they can take photos, and so I had records of them taking photos, which is, you know, another form of this surveillance. Are the robots watching us, or, you know, are the owners of the robots watching us?
Oh, so you could, from a remote location, have Jibo take a look around the house and report back to you?
No, Jibo doesn't do that yet. There are certainly robots that do that, but she was telling Jibo, take a photo, because Jibo does have cameras, and said, "Jibo, take a photo." And when I would come home, I would see, oh, Nanny took a lot of photos with Jibo. they're very cute, but, you know, yeah. I mean, all fun and games right now. But this fun little innocent robot, you can see a lot of problems.
Well, yeah, and there's a point at which it will sort of cross the line from being a toy and a novelty to being something more serious than that. And the price point, Jibo costs $1,800, I guess, will mean that this is another set of first world problems. Joanna Stern is with us from Culver City, California. We're talking about what was on the floor at this year's Consumer Electronics Show. I'm Ray Suarez. It's On Point.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Got a deal for you. Spend about 10 minutes with Up First, and you're ready for the day. You are informed for the day, connected for the rest of the day. Up First is the morning news podcast from NPR. One tap, and you've started the day informed. Find Up First on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. My guest this hour, Joanna Stern, personal technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She's just back from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Joining us now from Las Vegas to talk about how we can use all these new gadgets in a more environmentally responsible way is Callie Babbitt, an associate professor of sustainability at RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology. She's been at the Consumer Electronics Show this week, presenting her research on electronics and waste. Professor, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you so much for having me.
It makes sense, I guess, from both the manufacturer's point of view and also from a more, I guess, socially responsible point of view, that if we're going to fill our lives with these things, we ought to do it in a more efficient way. Is this a part of the science of this that's moving ahead quickly?
It is, and it's fascinating because traditionally electronics have gotten a really bad rap for both the resources consumed in their manufacturing, the energy that's used while they're used in our homes, and then finally the waste that we still haven't quite figured out how to manage in a 100% efficient way. However, there's a lot of new thinking about both how to design and manufacture these products to themselves be more sustainable, while at the same time using them in ways that can create really interesting and innovative social, environmental, and economic change.
There was a sort of material stream leading a lot of this stuff to developing countries. I've been in places where you can smell vile fumes, probably toxic fumes, where they're cooking electronics to extract certain substances from it, or dangerously using chemical solvents to extract precious metals from things like circuit boards and so on. If your vision of the future gets its way, will we be doing less of this? Will things be more easily reusable, easily recapturable?
Right. Well, there's actually kind of a double-edged sword of this innovation that's happening. On the one hand, we have consumers and manufacturers all pushing towards miniaturized products, products that can do many, many functions. You think about the smartphone. We're now buying just a smartphone, not also an MP3 player, a digital camera, a camcorder, et cetera. At the same time, you have a lot of products that are naturally getting smaller and lighter. We used to own about 2.5 of those big, boxy cathode ray tube televisions per household in America. Now we've replaced those with flat panel displays. That has not only reduced the mass that has to be processed and then recycled, but it's also effectively gotten rid of lead and mercury in some of the older technologies. So on one hand, technology is leading us towards a shrinking resource stream, and that actually makes it a little bit easier to manage, and it means that we're consuming less of the hazardous materials that have traditionally made recycling so problematic. On the other hand, what we're also finding is that a lot of the gadgets that I've seen this week and that we all love are, as they're very small, very challenging to disassemble, to reuse, and recycle. One of the case study products that we looked at in our research was fitness trackers. And this is a product that's seeing enormous benefit to society in terms of getting people moving, walking versus using fossil fuel-powered transportation. On the flip side, they're notoriously difficult to recycle, repair, or upgrade if you wanted to extend their life. So there's a little bit of a double-edged sword, but I think that there's a lot of conscious companies and now startups that are really trying to tackle this in a meaningful way.
I guess you have to introduce that thinking earlier on in the design process, in making prototypes, and start asking yourself hard questions about how much of this stuff do we use and how do we get it back. You can't do it after the fact, as you mentioned.
Exactly. We have to be a lot more proactive, and that was the theme of some of the research we shared. But I was also very encouraged by some of the companies that we talked to. One of the companies that Joanna actually featured earlier this week in her column is Colette Technologies. They make an anti-theft purse, maybe not directly related to sustainability, but we had a very exciting conversation about a real effort on their part to think about how to source the materials, whether the purse should be leather or an alternative material that has less environmental footprint. And then what is really important for wearable technology is how do you then remove the electronics after they've been integrated into a product? Because many wearables, once you've put the electronics in, is it electronic waste? Does it go in the regular waste stream? Can it be recycled through textiles recycling? We have to be able to get these materials back out. And we also awarded this year for the first time Climate Innovator Awards, and one of the companies there who won, Conservation Labs, makes a really exciting smart water sensor that uses some really new technology to detect leaks and water use in household and then give consumers tools to reduce that. These are all startups, and they're featured in Eureka Park, which is sort of the early and emerging tech and startup part of the Consumer Electronics Show, and I think that's where you're seeing a lot of really interesting ideas starting to add sustainability at the design phase.
One of the things that's filling up the bins at my local electronics store are batteries. They must make up a big chunk of the overall waste stream in the electronics world.
Yes, and I think this is something that's going to increasingly grow and be important, both on the material supply side and for recycling. Almost every product that I looked at this week has had some form of lithium-ion battery or other technology for energy storage. And then we're all buying additional battery backups to recharge these products when they've drained the battery. And so lithium-ion batteries are really complex and interesting products. They use a lot of materials. We think a lot about lithium, but there's also cobalt, manganese, nickel, and other materials that have some concerns about scarcity and how they're mined and extracted. On the other hand, we're also seeing electric vehicles taking up these same kinds of technology just at a very large scale. And so that's going to be a competing market for the materials and another source of the waste stream. So far, there's some limited recycling happening around the world, but there has to be some rapid scale-up of recycling and recovery infrastructure for these batteries.
Callie Babbitt,
you've got thousands of people.
Go ahead, Joanna.
And you've got thousands of people now going into Apple stores looking to replace the batteries in their phones because Apple's offering them for $30. So it's going to be
exactly.
A lot more batteries needed to be recycled.
Callie Babbitt, who you've been listening to, is an associate professor of sustainability at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Ileana writes, I think self-driving luggage that follows you around in airports is a good way to get your luggage stolen. Montreal, Canada is next. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Joanna. I'm calling from another country, as you can tell, so maybe that's why these consumer-related products seem to be just so linked to the American way of life. And for just an example, that famous suitcase that walks itself around, it would be useless in my city four or five months of the year because we are covered in snow, and it could never put on snowshoes, let me tell you that. But more to the point, the issue of sustainability also seems to be almost inevitably a second thought when it's a consumer-oriented marketplace that we're talking about. And once again, let me relate to that question of the luggage. It's exactly the wrong approach to build a lot of these little tiny lithium-ion batteries into everybody's luggage trying to keep the weight down. But then when it runs down or becomes less useful, A, the luggage has to be thrown away because it simply can't follow you around anymore, and B, it becomes a fire hazard in the cargo hold of your airplane, and eventually the airlines are going to refuse to take it if they don't already. Why isn't the thought to market these products to the airports where everybody needs it and where the airport can handle them on a mass market basis, replace the batteries as needed, and don't have to take them up into the air? Is that ever part of the marketing consideration, Joanna?
Yeah, I spoke to two companies that make the luggages. I mean, one thing that is very good is both of the batteries are swappable. So the battery comes out, and so that's because the TSA or whatever security or safety regulators need to you know, inspect, they can look at it. So they are building these products in mind with the airports and with safety in mind. As for the point about, you know, if this is the American way of life, funny enough, the one company that makes TravelMate makes a suitcase, I believe they're out of Canada, and 90 Fun is another suitcase company, and they're from China. And one of my favorite things about CES is actually that many of the companies I meet with are from around the world. Met with a great company that makes a robot. They're from Russia, another company from Sweden. So it's a nice thing about the show.
Boston, Massachusetts is next. And Michael, thanks for your call from Montreal. Steve is calling us now. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, how do you do?
Okay.
My name is Steve Chambers, and I'm actually the CEO of Jibo. I've spoken to Joanna before, and I heard you talking about the product, so I thought I'd clarify that we're a local company in Boston, and Jibo's featured at CES and has been on air and whatnot, but he is $899 in terms of his price. There was a slightly higher price quoted, and I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Oh, well, thank you for doing that, and it's great that things can work out in such a way that you can hear the program and make that correction in real time. Is the general trend of all these smart machines downward, Steve? Are they getting to be both more feature-laden and cheaper at the same time?
Well, I think that the difference between there are companies like Amazon and Google trying to hit a very low consumer price point because they want to own the footprint of your home. And therefore, they want to reduce the economic barrier so you and I in every room of our home enable it with a voice-activated service, for example. Our aim at Jibo is something very different. We're providing a different level, trying to provide a different level of experience and richness. So it isn't a price point game as much as it is a depth of experience game and just a fundamentally different way of interacting with technology.
Steve, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Covington, Louisiana, where Keith is on the line. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just had a quick question about reliability and safety. I really like all the cool toys that we get these days. I'm glad to be alive. However, the most reliable thing that we've ever had is your touch-tone telephone circa 1985. And if you work in an automated environment, then you have a redundant emergency stop system to prevent damage to the machine and to yourself. I don't hear about things like this very often. So my concern is that in our breakneck pace of give consumers what they want to buy, can we get anything as reliable as what we used to have or as safe as what we used to have?
That's a good question for both my guests, both Joanna Stern and Callie Babbitt. Do we rush things to market because of the gee whiz factor before thinking through all these other exigencies? Professor?
Well, I think that clearly this call and some of the other discussions underscore the need for a more proactive approach. You know, I think we all saw a fail-safe this week when all the power went out here at CES and everything stopped working. But on a serious note, I think there's a lot of opportunity here for thinking through these technologies in a meaningful way. And I think there's another. Many of the ones that I saw, especially around the autonomous vehicle technology, where safety is the real key concern there, there are many, you know, you're seeing technology with layers and layers and layers of safety-oriented technology built in. So I think it's first and foremost on many of the company's minds.
Joanna
and
Stern?
I would say, yeah, so, you know, I have a lot of experience reviewing products over almost 10 years now, a little bit more, and it definitely is a trend that I've seen. I would say in the last 5 years, companies have started to rush out products that were not yet ready, that were not fully capable, mostly because software updates make it so easy for them to say, we're going to have that, we're going to improve that, or we're going to fix that. And you can even improve battery life with saying, you know, we're going to have a software update that's going to fix that. And so whether it's because they wanted to rush to market because there was another competitor out there, whether they wanted to do it because they could say, oh, we're the first that has this thing, it certainly is a trend. And it's very frustrating for at least early adopters who are buying this stuff and saying, this thing just doesn't work. And we've seen this from major companies. You know, Apple especially has sort of taken the software update as a crutch. Oh, we'll fix that in a software update. We saw that a lot in the last iOS 11 release.
I'm glad Callie Babbitt mentioned the blackout at the Consumer Electronics Show. I mean, obviously, one of the great ironies of all the places you could have a blackout, the CES is probably one of the most revealing ones. But at the same time, as it revealed just how dependent we are on electric power, it also was a reminder of how well we've adapted. Everybody pulled out phones with flashlights in them and started to walk around the store. Now, had this happened at CES 30 years ago, not everybody had a flashlight in their pocket, that's for sure. Alex is
that's
calling.
Right. I think it, mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it. I think it underscores the complexity that we're now looking at. You know, we're no longer just talking about home technologies. Now we're seeing this integration of systems of systems. So we have your home, your vehicle, and then we're also talking about the electric utilities. And so increasingly there's going to be this vast integration across all of these systems. So the issue of reliability that was mentioned, we have to think about that now at multiple scales, because the energy grid is one that reliability is critical to and an essential part of all of this functioning.
But interruption in electric power, Joanna Stern, is more than just a slight inconvenience. It means all kinds of things can't go on in your house. In many houses, you can't even light the stove to boil a pot of water.
Not until, I mean, it becomes even worse when those batteries go out, right? Like, I think it's great that everyone had the flashlights, but that was the power outage lasted an hour. What happened in 3 hours when our phones went completely dead? How reliant are we? I think this is a big theme we're talking about in the last hour. How reliant are we? How addicted are we? How would we communicate without our phones? I mean, it makes us kind of think back to 10, I mean, more than 20, 25 years ago. How did we get around without smartphones?
Even during power interruptions, the phone used to work. I'll bet there are hardly any public phones at a place like the convention center in Las Vegas, where there used to be this long row of them.
Yeah, or who has quarters.
I want to thank my guests this hour, Callie Babbitt, Associate Professor of Sustainability at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joanna Stern is Personal Technology Columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Great to have you with us. And to our caller earlier who thanked me for taking over the show, I have not taken over the show. That fine correspondent John Harwood will be in next week, guest hosting On Point. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio, or follow me at Ray Suarez News. Coming up Monday on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we'll talk about race and social justice. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. Thanks for listening.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.